Welcome to Scientifica, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith.
This is Average Joe Aguirre, joined today by members of our scholar team, biochemist Fuz Rana, astrophysicist Jeff Zwering, and molecular biologist and Jeanette A.J. Roberts. They will be sharing exciting research from the front lines of the scientific journals and discussing the apologetic implications. You will hear from each in round table fashion today. We have determined the roll of the dice. Nobody got hurt. That's why we did it before the microphones were turned on. And AJ, you'll be going first today. So let's hear about your discovery that you'd like to report on. Scientists have found a critical step in DNA repair, and this concerns cellular aging. So let's hear about this one.
Great. Thanks, Joe. It's good to be here today. I've been working on developing a talk for the cruise, actually.
Coming up very soon.
Actually, two talks for the cruise are going to be new for me. And one of them is actually hopefully also going to second as a series of blogs. And it's the category is science and the spiritual disciplines. So, you know, maybe some people aren't too comfortable with the concept of spiritual disciplines or with the word discipline itself. But I think there are some incredibly interesting apologetic points that can be brought out from scientific studies that suggest many of the things and activities that Jesus modeled for us and encouraged or even commanded us to do contribute to our health and well-being and to our flourishing. So it's not just good for us spiritually to engage in these things that draw us closer to God, but science is actually showing that some of these things may in fact have physiologically positive effects. So it suggests to me that verses like John 10:10, where Jesus says that he came to give us life and give it to us in the full or more abundantly, that maybe we could take that a little bit more literally to mean that if we're doing the things that Jesus modeled for us, that our life will be more full and abundant, even here on this earth, and not just in a spiritual way, but in a physical way, well-being way. And then after Jesus serves the disciples through the washing of the feet, you know, he says, you'll be, now that you know these things, you'll be blessed by God if you do them. Or even, maybe this is really a kind of a stretch, but the verse in Isaiah 65 where it says, no longer will babies die when only a few days old. No longer will adults die before they have lived a full life. No longer will people be considered old at 100. Only the cursed will die that young. So it's interesting to me that some of the spiritual activities and disciplines and practices that Christians have practiced through the centuries as modeled by Jesus or taught by Jesus can actually have positive effects. So things like prayer and worship and service and fasting. So it suggests to me that science not only points to Christian truths like the origin of the universe out of nothing on God's command, or human exceptionalism because we're made in the image of God as spiritual and physical beings with rational and relational and creative capacities, but also to the truth and goodness of Christian teachings about lifestyle and spiritual activities that are part of our relationship with God. So I think it's pretty cool series to be thinking about, and that's the title of one of my talk is Science and the Spiritual Disciplines. So most recently I've been looking at the research on intermittent fasting, right? And I figured that topic's going to go over really well on the cruise. but I'm impressed at all the benefits that we can gain from the practice of intermittent fasting. And of course, you know, if we look at physical benefits or lifestyle benefits, that really shouldn't be our motivation for pursuing the spiritual disciplines, but it's kind of a nice little joyful side effect, right? That if we're doing those things that are drawing us closer to God and doing those things that help us become maybe more Christ-like or sensitive to the Spirit, that they're also going to have physical benefits as a sort of side effect or bonus. So intermittent fasting has been shown to help improve cognitive function. It can increase neuronal plasticity. It can increase resistance to metabolic and oxidative stress. It's actually neuroprotective against drugs that can induce anxiety. It's been shown to increase neuronal density and the ability to have locomotion and physical function after treatment with drugs that would impair those things. Intermittent fasting may also help prevent diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease. And it can be through things like dopaminergic neurons and the effects that fasting has on our physiology and the side effects of those effects on neuron cells in particular. In mice at least, it's been shown, mice and rats, and bacteria and yeast, it's been shown that intermittent fasting or caloric reduction can actually lead to increased lifespans. And that's whether the fasting is sort of an every other day type of fasting, or maybe as long as 4 days over the course of a week, or even just a 24-hour, sometimes even just a 12 or a 16-hour fast. But certainly the kind of fasting that we think about, I think, as Christians would be a one-day fast. But it's shown in rats an 83% increase in lifespan. It's shown 75% longer time of development. And so actually it's a delayed growth development, but that correlates also with a longer lifespan. And then it's also been shown to be linked to improvements in the DNA repair pathways, intermittent fasting. And some of the ways it's linked to that is through a couple of different DNA repair proteins. And some of those that have been identified are in a class called sirtuins.
Sirtuins.
So there's one called SIRT1 that's been linked to increases following intermittent fasting in SIRT1 and in NAD levels that suggest that these DNA repair mechanisms, although SIRT1 and the other SIRTs in the SIRTUIN family, SIRT1 through 7, have multiple metabolic and cellular functions, but one of them is in DNA repair. And so DNA repair is another thing that I find absolutely fascinating. And it's actually going to be part of my second cruise talk, one of the points that I bring out in my second cruise talk. But today's article addresses DNA repair and cellular aging at a molecular level. And so I just want to talk a little bit about DNA repair because I think it's also a very powerful area of scientific research that could be used as a Christian apologetic. And one of the articles that's already out there on the RTB article pipeline was written by a couple of guest authors, David Dyke and Henry. Hugh Henry and Dan Dyke. And theirs was written about the time that the 2016 Nobel Prizes were being handed out, because three of the eight DNA repair pathways were actually work that the individuals who they and the people in their lab performed were recipients of the 2016 Nobel Prizes. So the eight pathways that are involved in DNA repair are the basic scission repair pathway, and that was Thomas Lindahl's group that won the Nobel Prize for that. There's a mismatch excision repair, nucleotide excision repair, and both of those were associated with Nobel Prizes in Paul Modrich's group and Aziz Sankar's group. But cellular DNA is subjected to all kinds of external things and internal stresses that can cause damage to the DNA. And it's not just damage from external and internal sources, but it's mismatches that occur during DNA replication, or it's errors that occur in DNA replication, that there are over 200 different factors and enzymes that have been identified that play a role in helping DNA maintain its integrity. And I just think that that's an incredible concept and an incredible number. And if you want to see one way to approach that apologetically, you can check out the DNA repair article on RTB's website by Daniel Dyken.
Hugh Henry.
I don't know, I can't remember the other guy's name. But as I was reading through the literature looking for articles related to the benefits of fasting, and ran across one that actually points to a link between the benefits of fasting and DNA repair, I kind of got very excited. So this was just in the Science issue of March 24th of this year, but it's a research group at Harvard in David Sinclair's lab. have identified some of the contributing mechanisms that are likely linked to the benefits obtained by caloric reduction or intermittent fasting and possibly even exercise. But they involve the DNA repair mechanisms, CERT1, and another one that I haven't quite introduced you to yet, but is the topic of the paper, is, I'm looking for the long name. It's basically a polymerase that's involved in the basic scission repair pathway, and the abbreviation for it is PARP1. But what they've shown in this paper is that independent of CERT1 activity, which is another DNA repair mechanism that's involved in homologous recombination and end joining, is that the PARP1 interacts with another protein that's found through all kinds of different organisms and all different kinds of cell types called the DBC1. And DBC1 is actually inhibitive of the DNA repair mechanisms, and it actually contributes to a lack of repair of DNA damage, both in the CERT1 complex scenario, but also in the PRP, the PARP1 complex. And so they went in and they asked, how is this complex DBC1 interfering with the ability for DNA repair that's dependent upon the PARP1 protein? And what they found out is that it's actually another role for NAD. And NAD is a cofactor that's probably most often associated with redox reactions. And NAD stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And NAD plus.
Don't ask us to spell it, right?
Well, Fuzz could do that for you for sure.
I bet he can.
I might be able to if I wasn't stumbling through what I'm trying to say. But NAD, in addition to being a cofactor in redox reactions, is also a substrate for the function of some of the enzymes that are involved in DNA repair, including the CERT1 protein and the PARP1 protein. And so they asked if they could identify how NAD was playing a role in the DNA repair in the context of PARP1. And they actually found out that it's not just a substrate that's used by PARP1 for DNA repair, but that it's actually a regulator of protein-protein interactions. And so that's a novel finding in this paper. And they actually, it's not a direct interaction between NAD and PARP1 that's playing the critical role here, but between NAD and the DBC1, which is the inhibitory protein for DNA repair. And so they've identified a region of the DBC1 protein that is a binding site for NAD1, or for NAD. And that binding site is something that's referred to as NHD, and I'm not going to tell you what that stands for. It's not so important. But those NHD domains are actually prevalent through many different proteins. So that suggests that there are many other proteins out there that are possibly binding directly to NAD, and that NAD may have a global role in regulating protein-protein interactions and not just the one that they were talking about in this paper. But so NAD can be upregulated during intermittent fasting. And they've also found that CERT1 can be upregulated during intermittent fasting. And so what they've shown in this paper isn't pertaining to fasting, but pertaining to DNA repair, which is suggestive that one of the benefits that we gain from intermittent fasting is that NAD is having this sort of global effect on our cellular health based on its ability to maintain DNA integrity. So what they did here in this paper is they basically took the precursor for NAD, which can be transmitted across cellular membranes. It's a product called nicotinamide mononucleotide, or NMN for short. And they basically took old-aged mice who have reduced NAD activity and reduced PARP1 activity, and they treated the water of the mice for a week with NMN. And actually, if you're following the aging or anti-aging literature or the popular media about products that contribute to anti-aging, you'll see that NMN is one of those cofactors that's being sold as possibly an anti-aging factor. And this research actually would confirm that concept. So mice that received the NMN, they actually had increased NAD, increased PARP1 activity. They had decreased complexes or dimers of the protein PARP1 and DBC1, which I told you inhibits PARP1. Well, it inhibits PARP1 by directly binding to it. But when NAD is increased, it competes the DBC1 off of the PARP1, and it actually binds the DBC1 and frees the PARP1 to have its positive DNA repair effect. And then they also saw a decrease in the molecular markers for DNA damage. So that's pretty convincing that NAD is having this major effect in helping to regulate our DNA damage and DNA repair processes. Which one of the other implications, it was also brought out in this paper, which I find is incredibly fascinating, is that DNA can be damaged by radioactivity. Things like UV radiation and these types of gamma radiation and that sort of thing. So if they took mice and they pre-treated by feeding them in their water, NMN, and then they exposed them to gamma radiation, what they found out is that they didn't have the associated DNA damage to significant levels, and they actually saw that there were reduced molecular markers of DNA following radiation. They did one more experiment where they actually exposed the mice to radiation first and then treated with NMN, and they found there as well that they had increased PARP1 activity and decreased DNA lesions. So it's pretty fascinating, I think, to think of they may be onto something. Now, albeit all of these experiments were done in mice, and having worked in animal models for years with viruses and vaccine proof of concept studies, we had a saying that mice exaggerate. Oh, mice lie and monkeys exaggerate. So you always have to take that into account. But the fact that these domains, like the NHD domain and NAD and DNA repair mechanisms, are pretty global in the presence in different and variety of organisms, from yeast to bacteria to flies to mice to humans, there's good suggestion that this is going to be a strong argument from inference that this has application in human well-being.
Here's my question as a layperson. What is the approximate shared DNA between humans and mice again?
I don't know if I know that fact.
Fuzz, do you know what?
It's going to be like less than 40%.
In other words, these are done all the time, these mice studies, because they're good models, as you say.
Well, they sometimes are good models, right?
If you can
set up the model in such a way that you're, whatever it is that you're trying to test for, you can see a similar metabolic process or a disease process in the mouse, then you can say, well, we see similar metabolic processes or disease processes in humans. So if whatever intervention we want to take, possibly in humans, has an effect in mice, then we can make those types of extrapolations.
Now, but how long do mice...
But like, you can't use mice as a model for HIV, right? Because HIV can't infect mice.
How long do mice live?
So it depends on the mouse and the strain, but an old age mouse would be anything pretty much over a year and a half.
Okay.
A 2-year-old mouse would be an extremely old mouse.
I think you mentioned 83% earlier that they
83% life span increase. That was done in rats and with star rats. And
okay.
I'm not really sure what a rat's lifespan is because I haven't worked with rats as much.
Nevertheless, a layperson, to me, that sounded impressive that they were getting those kinds of results. So I'm thinking, forget the wine and resveratrol. Forget all
resveratrol.
That. Sign me up for these fasting and.
But see, that's just it. Is the resveratrol and these other compounds that they're suggesting that we take? What they're probably doing is they're probably elevating some of the same cofactors that are elevated when we go through an intermittent fasting period or a caloric reduction intake period, right? So in the case of the rats and the mice, it was the caloric reduction or the intermittent fasting that raised, probably, I don't know that any of those experiments looked directly at that, but there is one here where it says fasting promotes the expression of SIRT1, an NAD-dependent protein deacetylase. But it also shows the NADs increased in that. And I think that experiment was done in mice, not in humans.
Yeah, resveratrol is a sirtuin activator.
Right, right. So it all complexes sort of into the same types of pathways that are probably networking with one another.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Wow, interesting. Fuzz, what do you make of this? Because recently you've been called on the carpet for saying something to the effect that exercise and diet doesn't necessarily help.
No. Exercise doesn't help with weight loss.
Weight loss. There you go.
But if you want to lose weight, it's through your diet that you have to.
Okay. Yeah, I was misquoting you.
Yeah. But there are studies that are indicating that exercise has enormous benefits, but one of those benefits is not actually promoting weight loss, though that's the common perception. Mm. But
I guarantee that if you're doing caloric reduction or intermittent fasting, that will coordinate with weight loss.
Yes, it will, of course. Yeah. You know, and, the thing that's interesting is, highlighting, as AJ is saying, the benefits of fasting for our health, for promoting our longevity. And again, of course, this is a biblical practice, but this work also helps to account for the long lifespans that we see for the patriarchs in Genesis 5 and 11. Mm-hmm. If you take those lifespans to be literal, which I do, that this type of work actually provides perhaps some explanation for how humans could have lived that long, because you could see subtle changes in biochemistry actually having dramatic impacts on life expectancy. And we talk about that extensively in Who Was Adam, if people really want to get into it, how the work in the biology of aging, I think, actually legitimizes the long lifespans of the patriarchs.
Mm-hmm. I'm impressed, Joe, that you knew about resveratrol. Have you been trying it out or something?
No, I haven't. But Fuzz has written about this before.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting discovery, and I think it has the line of logic behind it is intriguing, because it's basically saying that, if I understand correctly, but by doing things where we are pursuing knowing God and the practices suggested in the Bible, that not only does that have benefit in bringing us closer to God, but it also physically takes care of us.
Yes. Yeah.
That, in terms of developing responses to the homosexual community or whatever, that there are biblical practices that are not only, they're not just moral issues, but they also have physical, there's reasons why those are there, not just because God likes this and not that they're actually designed. They help us live in a way that we're designed to live. So.
Yeah, but maybe some of those commands or examples of lifestyle type choices, mm-hmm, that we're supposed to be making have real sort of physical,
right? Yeah.
Outcomes or side effects,
yeah,
attached to them. Yeah.
You mentioned a caloric restriction. Did you say the ideal was one fast 24 hours, but I think you said even 12 hours had
a benefit? So if you look at the literature, there's all kinds of literature that you'll have to sort through. And some of the studies are caloric reduction, where you basically are feeding animals, the animal models, just a reduced amount of calories per day, so you're limiting the amount of food that they get, as opposed to just ad libitum, where the animal can eat freely whenever it wants, which is pretty much what we as humans do, at least those of us that are affluent enough to be able to afford food whenever we want to eat. So it could be just caloric reduction, and in comparison to that is something they call intermittent fasting. And intermittent fasting can be anything from as short as 12 to 16 hours to a 24-hour period to every other day not eating, or 4 days of basically not eating or caloric reduction over a 7-day week. So just depending upon the different studies, because there are dozens of studies out there, they'll define intermittent fasting differently. But I think it's interesting. Yeah, I'm not gonna make that comment, but look for my blog on this, because there's a couple of other interesting points that I want to bring up. I just want to make sure that I'm not misstating the data. But I think it's interesting that as we consider sort of the model of Christian fasting, unless you're taking on one of those radical 40-day fasts, that most models of Christian fasting are you know, give up protein for a certain amount of time, like on one day or for a month, or you give up eating for a 24-hour period, you know, maybe from dinner the night before until dinner the following day. And certainly those categories of intermittent fasting would fall into the range of intermittent fasting that's been shown to have positive benefit in all those areas that I mentioned up front. So, yeah.
All right. Interesting stuff. Thank you very much for that. Okay, well, we will now move over to Fuzz. And Fuzz, you have been studying rotary motors, the bacterial flagella in particular, and you promised to give us a very short description of how this motor works and get into the details, right?
Yeah, well, I'll, having trouble here with the microphone. I'll do my best here. You know, the
irreducible complexity, right?
Yeah, well, that'll factor into this. But the article that I want to talk about was published in the April 14th edition of Science by researchers from the University of Utah that were studying the assembly process of the bacteria flagellum. And of course, this is very important work because by understanding how something as complex as the bacteria flagellum forms, and the flagellum, by the way, is an appendage in the cell envelope of certain bacteria that is functioning in effect like a rotary motor or a propeller system that will propel the bacteria through through the media it's in. And so by understanding how something as complex as a bacteria flagellum can assemble gives us just basic understanding of biochemical processes of assembly, and that's important. But also, if you know how the flagellum assembles, then it's possible to disrupt the assembly process, which means that you can potentially have new classes of antibiotics that affect, again, you know, the ability of bacteria, at least certain bacteria, to move through the medium. It also impacts the formation of biofilms and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the flagellum also is interesting because it's the icon of intelligent design. You know, if people are familiar with intelligent design or with the intelligent design evolution debate, they will have a picture of the flagellum immediately come to mind.
Yes.
And many people will point to the flagellum and argue that there's no way that evolution can explain how the flagellum could have evolved, and therefore life must stem from the work of a mind, from the work of a creator.
That's why you're bringing it to our attention.
Yeah, and actually, what I want to point out here with this particular study and looking at the flagellum as a case study in terms of how to make a case for design is that the way that people use the flagellum to argue for design is actually a flawed argument or an ineffectual argument, maybe more appropriately, and that when people do that, they are not making a sound case that's going to have an impact with skeptics or seekers who know something about biology. For people who can't hear the gospel because they're not convinced a creator exists, we need to help them with that by showing that science actually points to God's existence. And I think biochemistry is an arena where we can do that in a powerful way, but we have to make sure we're constructing our arguments in the best possible way. Because if we don't, then it's very easy for skeptics to dismiss the idea that God is responsible for the origin of the design of life. And if you think that's the case, then, of course, again, it's hard to apprehend the gospel, which is predicated on the fact that there is indeed a creator.
All right.
In fact,
very good setup there.
A few months ago, we recorded a video product called How to Build a Case for Biochemical Design, where I give a lecture kind of outlining to people how I think we can best go about constructing a case for design and how to avoid certain pitfalls in making the design argument. So this will be an opportunity to talk about some of those concepts as we unpack this discovery. Now, what I need to do to set the stage for those people who are not familiar with the bacteria flagellum is to try to create a visual picture with words for what the flagellum looks like and how it operates, and then also how scientists think it is assembled before this discovery makes any kind of sense. So I'll try to do this quickly, but there is a particular group of bacteria called gram-negative bacteria. And these are bacteria that have a very complex cell envelope. There is what is called the inner membrane or the plasma membrane. This is a membrane that essentially defines the cell. It segregates the interior of the cell from the exterior environment. There's another membrane that is outside of the inner membrane, cleverly dubbed the outer membrane. And that membrane, again, surrounds the cell and the inner membrane. And there's a space between the inner and outer membrane, inner and outer membranes called the periplasmic space. And in that space, there's all kinds of things going on that are very important, and all kinds of structures that are very important. One of the structures is something called peptidoglycan. It's essentially a complex of carbohydrates and small protein-like materials called peptides that form a meshwork, a complex meshwork, that is essentially the cell wall proper for the gram-negative bacteria. It gives structural integrity to the bacterium. It creates a rigidity to the cell. And the outer membrane is anchored to the peptidoglycan layer by something called bronze lipoproteins. These are kind of elongated proteins that bind to the peptidoglycan and also bind to the outer membrane. And there's hundreds, if maybe not thousands, of copies in the periplasmic space that are bound to the peptidoglycan in the outer membrane, kind of holding everything together. In fact, when I was in graduate school, I did a lot of work on gram-negative outer membranes, and we would purify from cells the outer membrane peptidoglycan complex and study how that interacted with certain compounds that had antimicrobial properties. So anyway, that's the cell envelope. The flagellum is a large protein structure that has over 40 different types of proteins that comprise it. Many of those proteins occur in large number of copies, and it's a massive, massive protein complex that is embedded in the cell envelope of gram-negative bacteria. In the inner membrane at the very base, you have a ring of proteins that are called motor proteins. On top of them is another ring of proteins that are called the stator proteins. And the motor proteins take electrical current and use something called a clutch protein to engage a solid protein disc in the interior of that ring. As these proteins intermittently engage the disc and then release it, it causes it to rotate. So now you got a motor working, and that rotation is translated through a drive shaft that comes off of the top of the rotor. It passes through the periplasmic space into the outer membrane through a bushing-like protein. It attaches to a hook on the exterior surface of the outer membrane, and to that hook is another protein complex that is essentially like a propeller-type structure. And so that whole ensemble is the bacteria flagellum. It's a very complex rotary motor that's electrically powered for all intents and purposes. A highly efficient machine operating near 100% efficiency. It can rotate up to 100,000 RPMs, stop in an instant, and reverse the direction. When the flagellum rotates in one direction, it causes the bacteria to swim through its environment. When it rotates in the opposite direction, the bacteria tumbles through its environment. And this is actually important because when it tumbles, it can change direction. And so there are chemical materials in the environment, and there are these receptors in the bacterial outer membrane. And based on the compounds that bind to the receptors, it alters the movement of the flagellar motor, the direction of the motor, so that the bacteria can swim towards high concentrations of nutrients and away from toxins or areas where there's low concentrations of nutrients. Very, very elegant system. And I think just by that description, people intuitively can recognize that this thing is incredibly complex, incredibly sophisticated, incredibly elegant. And so there's this intuition of design that we immediately have when we look at something like the flagellum. Well, the way in which the flagellum is manufactured is in and of itself a marvel. It's manufactured through a series of stages that resemble what's called just-in-time manufacturing. If people are familiar with manufacturing operations, one of the ways that you can most efficiently manufacture something is called just-in-time manufacturing, where you only bring raw materials to the assembly line at the point they're needed, and you very carefully control inventories so that you never have excess material on hand. You have the just right amount of material, and it's available at the just right point in time in the manufacturing process. And you can do calculations to show this is the most cost-effective way to manufacture. And this is how the bacteria flagellum is assembled. And we understand pretty well genetically how this assembly process takes place. We don't understand biochemically how the assembly process takes place. But at a genetic level, there are these three sets of genes that are called operons. Actually, an operon in a bacterial genome is a region of DNA that has a contiguous arrangement of genes that line up back to back to back to back. And all of those genes code proteins that work collaboratively to carry out a process inside the cell. So if you turn on the operon, all those genes will be expressed and all the proteins they encode will be produced. It's a very elegant way to regulate gene expression of proteins that have to be at precise levels for operations to take place inside the cell. And so there are three classes of operons that code for the proteins of the flagellum. Class one, when those genes are turned on, it's time to make a flagellum, we're going to turn on those genes, they produce these two activator proteins that bind to class two operons that then produce all the proteins that are needed to assemble the motor ring, to assemble the stator, to assemble the rotor, and to assemble the drive shaft. And that structure is called the basal body. And then when the class two proteins are produced, they also produce another set of proteins that are called inhibitors that will turn off the class one operon because we don't need to make any more flagella. The signal's been given, so we want to turn that off. And there's activators that will turn on the class three operons, and those will then start preparing proteins while the basal body is being assembled. Those proteins are being manufactured. When class three operons are turned on, however, some of the proteins that they produce are inhibitors that will turn off class two, so you shut down the production of proteins needed for the basal body because it's already assembled. You don't need them anymore. And then when class three proteins are produced, they assemble into the hook and into the flagellum, into the propeller-like structure. And so very, very sophisticated genetic control of the manufacturing process that, again, is a beautiful analog, a beautiful example of just-in-time manufacturing.
Is this going on constantly, by the way?
It will happen only when the cell needs to produce a flagellum.
Okay.
When it doesn't, these genes are turned off.
All right.
But there's a very highly orchestrated control of the genes so that, again, the right proteins are made at the right time for the assembly process. And it avoids having just a mass of proteins that are just gumming up the inner workings of the cell. It's a very efficient way to produce the flagellum. Now, these researchers at the University of Utah were interested in how does the drive shaft form. And it turns out that not only is this, again, flagellum complex made out of 40 different types of proteins, again, multiple copies of many of these proteins are needed to assemble these structures. It's a high-precision system. You have to have the just right amount of proteins that interact with each other in the just right way in order for the flagellum to function. The dimensions of the flagellum have to be high-precision. If they're not, the system won't function. So it's what Michael Behe would call an irreducibly complex system, which is a system that's made up of multiple parts where all the components have to be present. They have to be present in the right amounts, and they have to interact in a precise way for that system to have function. And this is very much the case for the flagellum. In fact, the authors of this study just marvel at how precise the flagellum is. And so they wonder, how does the cell assemble the flagellum biochemically speaking? So they studied the rod or the drive shaft as part of the process of trying to develop understanding for the assembly process. Well, it turns out that the Braun lipoproteins, which anchor the outer membrane to the peptidoglycan, are key players in this. These are kind of elongated proteins and the length of these proteins actually establish the dimensions of the periplasmic space, the space between the outer and the inner membranes. And they figured out a way to actually vary the length of the lipoproteins. And when they did that, they saw that the rod or the drive shaft of the flagellum would actually vary in length proportionally to the length of the lipoproteins. So on that basis, they conclude that as the rod or the drive shaft is assembled, and it's actually a hollow cylinder, it's not a solid material, it's a hollow cylinder, as it assembles, it'll continue to assemble until the drive shaft bumps into the outer membrane, and at that point, the assembly shuts down. And then what's neat is that the materials for the hook are then secreted through the interior of the drive shaft, which is hollow, and will start to assemble the hook in the outer membrane. And there's another mechanism that's called a molecular ruler mechanism that will actually regulate the size of the hook. I won't get into the details there. But the hook also is hollow, and then when it's time to assemble the propeller from the flagellin proteins, they're secreted through the drive shaft and through the hook to assemble it. So it's a very impressive assembly process. But the point here is that what's evident is that this process is sophisticated, it's elegant, there's an ingenuity to it. It's a high-precision system that's irreducibly complex. And again, intuitively, it looks like it's designed. Now, the way in which Christian apologists have tried to argue for design and have tried to challenge evolutionary explanations for the origin of the flagellum and hence the origin of life is to argue, well, if the system is irreducibly complex, it can't evolve through a stepwise process, which is what you would require for a Darwinian mechanism. And the argument is you can't assemble it in a stepwise process on an evolutionary trajectory because if you don't have all the pieces together all at once interacting precisely, the system doesn't have function. If there's no function, there's nothing for natural selection to operate on.
Sounds pretty good to me.
Right, right. The problem with that is that evolutionary biologists have proposed the way in which we can explain the origin of flagella, and things like flagella that are irreducibly complex, is through a process called co-option. Hmm. And the idea is that you're not assembling the flagellum in a stepwise manner across an evolutionary trajectory. What you're doing is you're assembling a set of intermediate systems where those intermediate systems carry out different functions than the flagellum or the final product that you're interested in, again, in an evolutionary sense. And so you have these intermediate systems that can then be duplicated through gene duplication to produce multiple copies. And those systems now are free to evolve, and they can co-opt other components of other cellular machinery to produce new machinery that carries out new function that may benefit the cell. And that, in turn, that process can go on and on and on. Through a series of co-optive steps, or sometimes it's called exaptation, you can assemble in a stepwise manner things like the bacteria flagellum. And as a case in point, there's something called a type 3 secretory apparatus that is essentially the basal body of a flagellum. So people have pointed to that and said, look, this is an example of an intermediate structure that carries out a completely different function for the cell that could have been co-opted to produce essentially the bacteria flagellum through some evolutionary steps.
So I'm curious there, have people laid out, you know, can you look in the cell and say, oh, this is, can they put together a picture that says, this would be something that would actually do all this? Or is it just say, well, we see co-option, we see bits and pieces, and so, you know, we think there could be a picture that's put together?
For the bacteria flagellum, nobody's come up with a significant pathway other than to say, here's the type 3 secretory apparatus. But there are other irreducibly complex systems where people have done that very thing, okay. where they've actually proposed a plausible pathway with sequential steps. Now, so the point is, when you try to argue for design using irreducible complexity, the response is going to be, well, we have co-option that in principle could explain how these systems come about. And so therefore, that the design argument unravels. And the problem I have with that particular approach is it's essentially a negative argument. You're not really arguing for design. You're basically saying, I don't think evolution can explain that system, therefore it must be designed. But it's a very vulnerable argument because all it takes is somebody to come along and suggest plausibly how a system like that could come about, and the whole argument begins to unravel. Okay, yeah. And it's kind of a God of the gaps reasoning where you're inserting design or God in a place where we don't have understanding. And as
is
soon
there
as
some, I'm sorry, is there something similar in, I want to say red blood cells, fuzz, similar argument?
Blood clotting.
Blood clotting. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That would be a similar kind of argument that people have made where the system is irreducibly complex and therefore. Now, so
you know, it's interesting. I was trying to figure out how to articulate this, but that sort of argument is basically adopting that the only place God is involved, or the only place where we can see God's involvement, is where we can't have an explanation.
Right.
Which to me seems a very bad way for a Christian to go about arguing, because that plays right into the hands of the more we explain, the smaller God gets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in my view, I would rather make a positive argument for design. So instead of focusing on what evolution can or can't do and making a negative argument, I'd rather make a positive argument, and I'd rather try to make the argument in such a way that there are independent lines of reasoning that reinforce the case for design. So it's a multi-pronged approach that emphasizes positive reasons to think it's designed and downplays or is much more circumspect about challenging evolutionary explanations.
All right, throw me a lifeline here.
So for example, with this system, it is irreducibly complex. You could say that irreducible complexity, high precision, systems that are fine-tuned, that are optimal, that are ingenious, are markers for the work of a designer, right? If there's a mind that's producing those systems, those are qualities you'd expect to see. Moreover, the flagellum is a beautiful analog to an electrically powered rotary motor. The assembly process follows, again, it's an ingenious process that is an analog for just-in-time manufacturing. And so this allows us to make a revitalized watchmaker argument. That is,
that's where you're going.
So we focus on the similarity between human designs and the designs of biochemical systems, and that allows us to make a positive argument. And so we're using irreducible complexity, but we're using it in a positive sense as a marker for design, as opposed to saying it's a challenge to evolutionary explanations.
So it becomes this kind of a piece in a line of evidence rather than a smoking gun, silver bullet, we've got design argument here.
Exactly, exactly. Now, there's another argument that we could make that's completely independent of the watchmaker argument, and that is to note that the bacteria flagellum is so elegantly designed that it's actually inspiring nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. And there are researchers that are looking at the design of bacteria flagella and are trying to design what are called microbots, these nanomachines that can basically be propelled through liquid environments for medical purposes or for other types of purposes. But the point here is that the flagellum is so elegant in its design that it's inspiring new technology. This is called bioinspiration and biomimetics, and it's an exciting new area in engineering where scientists and engineers are turning to designs in biology systematically to advance technology. And so this, again, the flagellum is part of that whole biomimetics, bioinspiration project.
You know, I find that interesting because I remember when I was working full-time at UCLA, you know, they just got a fair number of colloquia come through there, and you get to hear some pretty kind of cool stuff. But I remember one talking about nano engineering, you know, and they could build these structures, and then they're thinking, okay, you know, you can actually, just the fabricating the structures was the impressive technology at the time. But then they're looking at this saying, you know, how do you build a motor that powers this? And so some guy got the idea, hey, wait a second, I think something in the cell does this. So they go yank that piece of machinery out, attach it to their little device, and it starts working. You know, I mean, it just, case in point of what you're talking about, that what the cell does is better than what we can engineer very often.
And that's actually, I think, an independent argument. You know, Jeff articulated beautifully. That's an independent argument for design. And in fact, I've dubbed this, this is, you know, my nomenclature. I've dubbed it the converse watchmaker argument. The watchmaker argument is basically we see designs in biology that are similar to human designs. We know that human designs require a mind. Therefore, the designs in biology must require a divine mind. Well, the converse watchmaker argument goes in the other direction. If the designs in biology are the work of a mind, they should be so elegant as to inspire our design efforts, our engineering efforts. And in fact, with biomimetics and bioinspiration, we see that very thing. So not only is the flagellum, again, this incredibly elegant analog to human designs, allowing us to revitalize the watchmaker argument, it allows us to make a bioinspiration argument as well. Now, biomimetics and bioinspiration, interestingly enough, actually provide us now with an opportunity to challenge the evolutionary explanation. So we can actually bring a critique to the evolutionary explanation that isn't, you know, of the nature of the irreducible complexity challenge, but rather it's a very different type of challenge. And it's this, that if evolutionary mechanisms truly produce the flagellum, or other biochemical systems that are inspiring engineering, the process for that production would be unguided, undirected, and it would involve co-option of pre-existing systems that are then put together to create new systems over and over and over again. That kind of design is a kludge. It's cobbled together. It's jimmy-rigged, whatever terminology you want to use. In fact, I was engaged in a conversation with Ian Tattersall, a very well-known evolutionary anthropologist, and he said to me, designs in biology are not optimal. They are kludges. They're jimmy-rigged together. Biologists are very clear to point out that evolution does not produce perfection, but systems that are, again, kludged. And I can show you quote after quote after quote where evolutionary biologists have insisted on that point. Okay, if that's the case, if co-option is the mechanism to explain the flagellum and other biochemical systems, then they should not be worthy of inspiring human engineering and human design. They would be the last place you would want to go to drive technology. And so it's not the same kind of either or, evolution can or can't do this, yes or no, but rather that response to the co-option is, again, maybe not as forceful, but I think it's actually something that is a lot more difficult for a skeptic to work their way around.
I think you may have already articulated the answer in what you just said in that additional part that you just brought in. But I've been sitting here thinking that there's a link sort of to the negative argument of evolutionary mechanisms can't do this to the very positive case that you made for making a positive case for design, and that being a much stronger, more robust argument. And it's, you put it as, it's unguided co-option, which is kind of a kludge effect. And the question that was running around in my mind is, okay, co-option happens. Let's concede that, because there are examples of that. But for co-option to happen in a series of events that would be necessary to produce an entirely complex system like a flagella, it does it blindly, or it does it non-teleologically, right? So that's that unguided principle. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be sort of something that would add to a negative type argument, but mm-hmm. one that's a really valid point, right? Is that these co-option events can't be teleological, right? They have to basically happen upon a functioning flagellum at some point. Even if you've co-opted three different things to make a functioning flagellum, if the intermediates themselves aren't immediately beneficial to the bacteria in that immediate environment. You know, I think this is probably along the same lines of arguments that Michael Denton makes, that, that they can't be gradually stepwise changes that are being approached through natural selection if that natural selection isn't constantly giving you a function for whatever's being co-opted, right?
Well, yeah, well, that was, Michael Behe's point, but you know,
I meant Denton when I said Denton. Just so
okay,
you know.
Okay. But yeah, that was also Michael Behe's point with irreducible complexity. And when I first heard the argument, I was actually impressed with it, the irreducible complexity argument, until I began to try it out myself with people that knew a lot about biology. And as I began to listen to how people responded to it, and I realized, okay, I could get into this never-ending argument.
Right.
As about what evolution can or can't do, or I can step back and say, look, people are not impressed by this argument. And so what I'm going to do is not use it.
Right.
And rather, I'm going to step back and say, how can I make a case for design that takes this intuition of design that I have and makes it more robust? And I think the watchmaker argument is powerful. I think this argument from bioinspiration, which is a relatively new argument, is powerful. And once we've made a positive case, then I think we can actually find places where we can say, but this is what you is required if indeed evolution has done this. This is the kind of system it's going to produce. And I don't think biomimetics and bioinspiration is a
result from that type of
right.
job.
And so that it, and again, it's not as forceful as saying definitively evolution can't do it, but I think it's the type of argument that actually is more inherently more robust because it's multi-pronged. And it, I think it's going to be something that will give a skeptic or a seeker some, a lot more to think about.
I often find that people that are making the evolutionary argument that they kind of ignore that idea of it's unguided, or they put it on a back burner in the sense of, oh, well, this could have happened and this could have happened and this could have happened. And this would have given it a benefit of survival in this situation, this situation, this situation. But to me, it's kind of it overlaps with this idea of how we try to anthropomorphize molecules or cells, and we kind of give them a volition of sort of knowing what's going to benefit them, and therefore I'm going to go co-opt that because I know it's going to benefit me. So that seems to get lost or tangled up, I think, in some of the evolutionary points that other people might be arguing in favor of.
Well,
and it's almost as if it's a guided evolution, even though they would never admit that.
Well, but I think an evolutionary biologist would say there are all kinds of instances where co-option happens, and these are just failed experiments that just don't persist in the cell. And occasionally you'll get that system where co-option happens, and there's some benefit that's provided, and that system then becomes, becomes elaborated on through evolutionary processes, and then in and of itself, it can then be co-opted multiple times. Many of those are going to be failed evolutionary experiments. So that's how they would argue. But you know what's interesting, and I'll stop because I've gone way too long here, is, you know, one of the rejoinders to the watchmaker argument is bad designs in biology, where they say, but what about all the bad designs? And so, you know, of course, the response is what we think to be bad designs actually turn out to be optimal designs over time. But again, the idea that scientists who are skeptics, who are opposed to this idea of design, would bring up bad designs, again, is intertwined with this idea that co-option doesn't produce optimal designs. It produces kludge jobs. And so in order to essentially dismiss the credibility of the bioinspiration argument, you've got to argue that evolution produces optimal designs. But again, but that takes away then the bad design rejoinder to the watchmaker argument. So when you start to produce a multi-pronged way of reasoning, it makes it very difficult, I think, for people to avoid, I think, the thrust of the point that there's powerful evidence that we can marshal in a number of different directions for a creator.
Well, and I wonder too, and I know you said you want to be done, but I do wonder if you now have evolution says this is the kind of designs we expect to see, whereas an intelligent design model says this is the kind of designs we expect to see, that now that motivates good research questions.
Yes.
Where you see something and you say, well, this looks kind of kludgy. Is it really? Or this doesn't seem to be a good design. Are we missing something? And so it actually inspires the scientific process rather than just says, well, that's the way it is, or, oh, God did it that way.
I think that's one of the side effects of sort of evolutionary arguments, is that if they see sort of a kludge job, they just kind of throw their hands up in the air and say, well, that's what we would expect. Whereas if you're coming at it from a design perspective, you might be like, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's something else going on here. So it actually opens those areas of research.
All right, now let's hear from Jeff. Jeff, scientists are always looking at exoplanets, and they've detected an atmosphere around an Earth-like planet.
Yeah, and that's kind of really what I wanted to get at, you know, is to discuss this idea that Earth, one of the things that makes Earth so habitable for life is that there's an abundance of liquid water on the planet. And, you know, I've made statements to the effect that in terms of searching for life beyond Earth, that it's on the order of a couple of decades before we'll have any sort of real convincing evidence for that. And so, you know, I just wanted to highlight three different discoveries that have been announced over the past few months that show that we still have a capacity to kind of probe into those. And one was announced by Keele University, and this is where they detected an atmosphere around an Earth-like planet. And not only did they detect an atmosphere, but they can actually make some sort of statement as to what might be in that atmosphere. And so what specifically what they were doing is they were using the transit technique of finding planets. That's where the planet passes across the face of the star. And in the as it does so, the disk of the planet actually obscures light from the star, and so you see a drop in light, typically something on the order of a percent of the amount of light that's blocked out. And so what they were doing, though, is that they actually were observing the transit in seven or eight different wavelengths of light or bands of light. And what they found is that in one particular band, the radius of the planet was larger. And, you know, so what that says is that for the other seven or other six or seven, that's measuring the actual surface of the planet, whereas this eighth band is measuring something bigger because the atmosphere is absorbing the light from the star. And so by comparing what the wavelengths of that band are with the other wavelengths, you can then begin to ask the question, what sorts of gases in the atmosphere would explain why this one particular band sees less light or sees light further out or absorbs light from a larger radius? And what they put forth is they say, you know, that methane and water are good candidates for what would be the molecules that would be causing this observation. And so, you know, you look at it, and they don't say they're finding water around this, but they talk about how this, given the temperature of the planet, that this could be a steamy water world. And, you know, they make these sorts of statements. And so I always think it's important to look in and assess, okay, what do they actually know, and what of this is extrapolating from what we know to what we think it could be?
Yes.
And so that was just one particular discovery, and I want to kind of just highlight all three and then kind of go back and kind of lay out where the apologetics comes into that or what sort of impact it has. So there's another planet, and I would say the one that they discovered was it's a super Earth around a M dwarf planet that's you know, about 40 light years away. So something relatively close that as we continue to improve our technology, it's close enough that we can make these sorts of measurements.
And it's got a great name, GJ1132B, right?
Yes, it is. So I did not, well, I mean, I understand why astronomers are very boring in their names, but they are boring in their names. So different one. It's this is HAT-P-2060, so a little bit better.
All right.
This is one. It's a Neptune mass planet where, again, they were using the Hubble Space Telescope, looking at it with, you know, again, oh, I'm going to draw a blank. I want to say it's the transit in all likelihood, because I think that's the kind of planet that was detected there. But again, they found absorption lines in the atmosphere of this planet, which are indicative of a relatively large abundance of water. In fact, much more. There's more water in this planet than would be expected for a planet that would be in our solar system. And so, again, they just found an abundance of water in or of water in the atmosphere of a Neptune-type planet around this star HAT-P-26. And then kind of the third one that I wanted to bring out, which is these are planets outside our solar system, but there's a instrument called Cassini that is orbiting, I'm going to draw a blank, I want to say Saturn, yeah. And Saturn has this moon called Enceladus, which we think is not a nice Spanish dish or Mexican dish. It's actually that's enchiladas, not enceladas.
But salad is enchilada.
Oh, that's okay. Well, that's I'm less impressed now. So I like enchiladas much better. Yes. But it's got a ice-covered surface. They believe there's a liquid ocean of liquid water underneath that, and then kind of unsure what's underneath it, but they, you know, kind of optimistic there's some sort of rocky core underneath it. But the neat thing, or one of the kind of cool things about Enceladus, is they've got this one feature on it where it's called Tiger Stripes, where they see evidence of organic molecules. But there are actually jets of material squirting out here. And so occasionally they've rerouted Cassini to fly through these jets of material or these plumes, and they find that it actually has, you know, made of liquid water, but or there's an abundance of liquid water in there. But also they found evidence of molecular hydrogen. And what's intriguing about that is that one of the best ways to get molecular hydrogen, especially in these kinds of abundances, is if you have a rocky surface water interface, you get hydrothermal activity, which will break, you know, if the rocks are a certain type of class, they'll break the water down and give off hydrogen gas. And so finding this hydrogen gas in there indicates that there is a liquid water ocean underneath the rocky or underneath the icy surface that also is in contact with rocky material. And so these are environments on Earth where there's actually a fairly thriving biological community on Earth. Now, so they're not saying that there's actually life here, but they're saying here's a condition which on Earth we see an abundance of life around.
And you're talking extremophiles or just life?
No, these are just methanogens, live off of methane and hydrogen in the environment. And so,
all right.
So, just a quick question. You said there was something that was indicative of like banding, like tiger stripes, that was indicative of organic material?
No. So what they see is on the surface, they've got these things called tiger stripes, and it's because they look kind of like tiger stripes. But as they've looked at it, they see spectral signatures of organic material.
Okay.
You know, and that's not organic material as in life is there, but just, you know, carbon-based structures. So, you know, the more generic organic sense. All of this to say is that as I've thought about this, one, I've got this book where I make a statement that it's going to be, you know, a couple of decades before we find any signature of life. And then here I find a couple of statements where we're finding finding water in planets of Earth-like or in the atmospheres of Earth-like planets. And I'm thinking, wow, am I off here or not?
Yeah.
I still think in order to get the technology where we can make any sort of measurement that we would be confident of, I still think we're a couple of decades out. But I think it's remarkable the advances we can make in what we're finding. And all of this kind of got me thinking, you know, again, how do I make an argument that Earth is designed in a way that doesn't set the argument of Earth? How do I make an argument that Earth is designed to support life that actually accounts for what we might actually find? And I find that very often the way I've thought about this sort of design argument, some because of my own thinking, but some because of the way it's been articulated by Christians, is that Earth is so unique in its capacity to support life, and water is so critical, and plate tectonics is so critical, that Earth is the only place where we're going to find those things. And I think in making that argument that, you know, I think it's that statement sets it up to where when we find things in the future, it seems like the case for Christianity is going to be weakened as we find stuff. Because, you know, as I kind of sat back and thought about it, you know, one of the things that occurred to me is that water's the third most abundant molecule in the universe. And so to make an argument that Earth is the only place that has water is almost certainly going to be wrong, because just the very processes that form planets are going, I mean, water is an abundant molecule in the environment where planets are going to be made. And so lots of planets are going to end up with water. Now, I think what makes Earth unique or very rare is the fact that 4.5 billion years later, it still has abundant ocean, or it has oceans of water sitting on its surface. And that's where, as I go and I look at what we find as we look at Mars and what we find as we look at Venus, is that we find these two planets that, like Earth, started with quite an abundance of water, but very quickly lost that water for one reason or the other. And Venus lost it for a different reason than Mars lost their liquid oceans. And so I guess this is just kind of a cautionary tale of, let's be careful how we make these arguments so that we actually have an appreciation of what we're going to find. And, you know, kind of as an analogy, I remember having a discussion with my major professor back in the late 90s. This was after we found a few planets outside our solar system. And I remember having a discussion with him in his driveway, and I made some comment about, you know, thinking that, or, you know, made some comment about Earth was going to be rare, unique. And he goes, "What? Does that mean you think we're not going to find any Earth-like or Earth-sized planets?" And I had to think about it for a second. And, you know, kind of the way he asked, I'm like, no, we'll find Earth-sized planets. It's just we're not going to find planets that have all of the conditions necessary for life to be there. And so, you know, it kind of made me stop and think that if my argument is predicated on Earth is the only place where there's water, or even Earth is the only place where there's liquid water, because, again, I think there's going to be lots of planets we find that have liquid water at some phase. What's remarkable to me is that Earth has maintained this habitable environment over 4.5 billion years. And so to me, the argument is not that given all of the stuff we see in the universe, there's only one planet like Earth where we would expect to find life. It's really, as we look at Earth, we see this whole slew of things that work together, that we see God's handiwork here to bring about life. And so the question to me, as I'm looking out at other planets, is not, is this planet like Earth in some way? Because I expect that we're going to find lots of planets that look like Earth in various ways. But really the question is, do I see evidence that God might have done work somewhere else to bring about life? Hmm. And so that I find just as an interesting scientific question as well as a theological question, because I just don't know what else God might have done.
So, yeah, I'm glad you made the theological leap there, because I'm sitting here going, you know, what are the theological things that we ought to be thinking about as we approach that type of question, right? Because obviously the Bible is God's revelation to us, right?
Right.
And so, you know, we are earthbound creatures in his image. And so it's our story. It's God's story to us that are created in his image. There's no reason that we should think, I think, from the abundance and diversity of life on planet Earth, that a creator who might be so endowed would have a diversity and abundance of life in his universe, if that was to some purpose of his own planning that he's silent on in our story, because it's irrelevant to our story.
Well, and I think you can make a reasonable case that we would expect to find life out there. Because when we look at life here on Earth, you know, I've talked a little bit about some of the extremophiles and gotten from Fuzz, you know, some of the insight into there. But, you know, the way I characterize it is that, you know, everywhere we look on Earth where life is possible, we find life. And even in a number of places we thought impossible at some point in time. And to me, that says God didn't need to do that. And I don't know that bacteria living in the hot springs in Yellowstone is somehow critical to life here on Earth or something. But to me, that says God just enjoys creating life. And so where he wants to, he does. And so
it might be critical to life, but it also might just be God, part of God's providence, right?
I mean, I agree,
Fuzz and I were talking about this at lunch. It's like, you know, I think we sometimes think in our little bubbles or without really broad perspective, because we're constantly gaining more knowledge and more information. And the more knowledge and information that we gain, it seems like more of what we have around us is either purposeful for life or providentially provided for us to do something with that might be serving creation. And so I have always thought that if we found life, even complex life, even some type of, I don't know if it would be hominid or intelligent life elsewhere, to me that would just argue again in favor of God's creative power, right? That it's the complexities that make life so unique here and the ability for us to flourish here are so intricately interdependent and designed that to find that type of life elsewhere, I think would just be, and I think as Christians, we need to be so careful not to read things into Scripture that's not there, that we're the only life in the universe. I mean, there's just nothing in Scripture that would suggest that, I think.
Yeah, you know, I think your points are very well stated. And, you know, again, as I was thinking about that, you know, I have to sit down and honestly ask the question, you know, what do I expect to find scientifically if the Bible's true? And, you know, as you said, I don't find anything in Scripture that talks about what God did out there. I mean, he's talked about the angelic realm, and he's talked about how the heavens declare his glory. But I don't see anywhere a statement in there about whether he created life out there or not. You know, and again, to me, what I found comforting and reassuring and challenging in this discussion is that it forced me to think about how I was thinking about this discovery. And it was one of those places where I was thinking, or at least had bought the idea, that this is the only place where we would expect life given all the probabilities. And it's like, no, that's not really the argument. It's what I look at is, as I see life here, we see that God has been at work here to create life, and we're valuable because we're created in his image. So if he decided to create some other creatures out there in his image that are either like us or created in some image to reflect his image in a way that we don't, you know, me having two kids didn't make my first kid less special.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, so God creating other life out there doesn't make us any less valuable. We're valuable because we're created in his image. If we find other life out there,
we're still created
in his image. Absolutely. So, you know, and so it just helps me think theologically properly.
And we still have a redemptive story, right?
I agree.
So, Joe, I think it's really interesting that you were talking about the names of the stars, and Jeff was suggesting the lack of ingenuity on the part of astronomers. And it's kind of like, you know, there is a scripture that says God's called them each by name. So I'm pretty sure that His names might be more interesting.
Yeah, it's like I could see it's, you know, God's catalog, God 1, God 2, God 3, God 3B.
Or it could be like George Foreman, name each one of his kids George.
God Jr.
Star.
I was just going to comment that from a lay perspective, I'm hearing you echo what Fuzz warned about earlier, that Christians need to be careful with how they argue, particularly when it comes to engaging a skeptic. You can't just run out there and hope to engage in apologetic arguments thinking that you're loaded for bear when you may not have what you think you have. That is, you can't say you can't reduce this system, irreducible complexity you were talking about earlier, Fuzz. There could be a comeback, mm-hmm. you said. And now here also, Jeff, it sounds like we need to exercise caution. We can't just go out there and say Earth is special, all of life is special. It is, in one sense. But hey, the moment we find some type of bacterial life or something out there, mm-hmm. if we've put all our eggs in one basket, and suddenly there's a life form out there, what does that do for some people?
Right.
Everything may come crashing down, but you're saying, hey, it need not be that way.
Right.
We can have both and. Right.
Well, and I would also say that as Christians, we need to be out in front of that discussion, you know, because I look at this discussion of, you know, how an atheist or a skeptic will frame it as, you know, Christians thought this was true of the world, that Earth was center, it was a special location, and then science came along and showed that, no, we're not special, we're just kind of... One, Christians never said that. You know, it's just a complete rewrite of what historically being at the center was theologically. Being at the center was the dregs, not the special status. But, you know, there is kind of this common perception that we're special because we're unique, when in reality, we're special because of who created us.
Right. Okay, great stuff. Anything else? Any other comments?
Well, you know, I think the maybe the take-home message for people that have made it all the way to the end of this podcast is, you know, that you have to do your homework. And, you know, I think there are people who are leaders in the church, in apologetics, in other areas, and we want to listen carefully to what they have to say and weigh it carefully, but we also want to test everything and hold on to what is good. And I would hope that people that listen to what I have to say would actually put those ideas to the test. And that doesn't mean going out and looking for somebody who's going to agree with your position, but it means actually really putting those ideas to a genuine test. It also means we've got to do our homework and make sure we really understand what people who are skeptics and who might hold differing views from the views that we hold as Christians, we need to really make sure we understand what those views are, why they hold those views. We need to be able to articulate and defend those views before we try to engage them and refute them. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to really do our homework, I think, is the bottom line. We need to be Bereans when it comes to apologetics.
All right, there you have it. I think that's Acts 17:11 or somewhere in there. Good verse to end on. Thank you for that, Fuzz. Okay, well, you've heard the podcast. Thank you for hanging in there with us. You know how to connect with the Scholar team on their Facebook and Twitter pages. On behalf of the team here, Fuzz Rana, Jeff Swerink, and A.J. Roberts, this is Joe Aguirre. Thank you for your support. We will see you next time on Scientifica.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.